the nature of Cree or Ojibwa. They sound like very image-based languages. You know, the roots of the meaning are right on the surface, and I feel that by having some knowledge of the roots of our modern languages, we can have a similar experience.
Yeah.
I use the example that my friend Lenore talks about of when someone first brought a kettle into their community. There was no Ojibwa word for kettle, but they did have a word for pail, and they did have a word for duck. So the word for kettle is now duck pail.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of Thompson talking about when you're speaking Cree, you always feel like you want to break out in laughter.
Mm-hmm.
It struck me that if your entire language was made up of images like that, of course you would want to laugh when speaking a language.
That's true. English is in many ways very abstract.
Yes.
If you think of Latin, that is pretty abstract too, I think. The other influence in English, of course, is from Germanic languages. And in the region I come from, they still speak Plattdeutsch, which is very close to English still, or English is still very close to that. And in our language, one example is hippopotamus. We call it Flusspferd, that means river horse, or rhinoceros. It's nashorn, nose horn, you know? Things like that. I know what you're talking about.
I have this feeling like it really connects to a part of the imagination which has to do with metamorphosis, with transformation, with possibility. That I think is also just because I'm talking in those terms connected to our physical beings. That in contemporary culture we don't see much of. I think it has to do with that denial of our physical realities that goes on. It's like the only place we seem to run into that sort of imagining is, say, in horror films. Or I saw a show of Inuit sculpture recently by a friend of mine, where he was using the conventions of Inuit sculpture that have to do with shamanism and shamanic journeys, as well as sort of the regular portraits of people. But because he lives in the city, it's like he's aware of using naturalistic detail in his works, and suddenly they jump out at you like that part of the imagination, because it's like there are these details from our everyday life in the middle of fantastic things. And I was quite excited by
it. I think that's something that at least struck me in your poetry. Very often you take very ordinary little everyday things and write about them, but the way you write about them and you portray them, they acquire a totally new dimension. And we see them in a way we've never seen them before. Like the one where you write about the fingers. Things like that. So the visual aspect seems to be very important. You see something and describe it in terms that at least I, and I think most other people, have never imagined them and seen them before. I guess, and help us to see things.
Yeah, I think I'm really interested in visualizing. I mean, I think it's part of the conventions of modern literature. I mean, we talk about images. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is visual imagery, even though, I mean, images also mean other sorts of, of sensation. But for me, it's also a very deeply rooted in my own body and the fact that I have poor eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess at this point it's the good fortune to have somewhat of a quack for an optometrist when I was a child, a man who believed that if you forced the eyes to work, that they would cure themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I went for a year with inadequate prescription lenses, during which time, of course, my eyes deteriorated.
Uh-huh.
But he also believed that television was no good for you. And it was like during that year that I first really got hooked on reading.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like through that bad luck of having this quack for an optometrist. Mm-hmm. I mean, after that, my parents took me away from him, and we went to someone who gave me glasses that would do the job would not cause me headaches and would not give me problems. But by going through that piece of bad luck, I mean, it's probably given this direction to my life where,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, not only am I someone who's interested in words, but is also interested very much in seeing things clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that results in the visual imagery, also results in, like for years I was a cine addict.
Mm-hmm.
I was
a what addict? A
cine movie addict.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was where I live in Toronto is like right on the subway line, which gives me direct access to three repertory cinemas.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first moved into Toronto, I for the first couple of years I would see four or five, you know, up to eight or ten movies a week. And that was just evening, sort of thing.
When you think about yourself as a writer, a poet, or dramatist, or so, how would you like to see yourself best as a poet, or as a dramatist, as a writer, as a native writer, as a Torontonian writer, or how do you? Do you think in those terms at all when you think about yourself as an author?
I guess if I had to use any terms, I think I would hope to become a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually gradually moving toward the idea of gathering a repertoire to actually be
mm-hmm.
a real storyteller mm-hmm. in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
But I find that what I value in the use of language comes from that idea of oral presentation. As much as I can appreciate the beauty of poems on the page and can appreciate the concepts behind things like concrete poetry, I find that they don't move me as deeply as something I can hear from someone else's mouth.
Yeah. And were you exposed to that kind of storytelling a lot as a child?
No. My family was Christianized with my great-great-grandfather's generation, and to that point, our family name was Cornelius.
Mm-hmm.
His first name at the time was Moses,
mm-hmm.
and when he converted to Christianity, he just flipped his name around and became Cornelius Moses.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that my sense of the beauty of English language probably is rooted in going to that Anglican mission on our reserve, and reading the prayer book and hearing hymns and.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to an all-Indian school on the reserve, or was it a mixed school?
Well, it was basically all-Indian. I mean, there were always a few white kids living
mm-hmm.
on the reserve, whether their parents were, you know, working there or whether they were just married into
mm-hmm.
our families.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is such a big community and such an old-established community.
Yeah.
I was really sort of never aware that there was there was sort of a problem of racism anywhere mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. It was only once I got off the reserve that I
when
really...
When was that?
When I finally went away to university, mm-hmm. when I actually spent a large amount of time off the reserve. I mean, certainly prior to that, I would go off for vacations mm-hmm. and things, and to visit relatives and friends, but before university, I just hadn't experienced I guess I'd always assumed that the way people treated each other on our reserve was Christian. Mm-hmm. And then when I was off the reserve and saw how Christianity was functioning out there, I had to question my assumptions about the way we were behaving. And I think it really... We were really behaving like Indians, but we were calling ourselves Christians, not to uh-huh. upset anybody.
Yeah. Are you a Christian these days?
No.
No. Mm. No, I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
So when you now use native traditions, like the coyote story that you said came from the Nez Percé, if you use native materials, mythology or oral tradition, historiography or so, that is all, those are contents that you would have learned in later life through reading, through hearing, observing?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a bit of luck when I was going to university, and that at the time, the education branch of the Department of Indian Affairs was putting together a bibliography of books by or about Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired Native students in the summers to come to Ottawa and compile this mm-hmm. annotated bibliography. So
is that this one with a sort of colorful cover with some, I think, beadwork on it?
Yeah, the final edition.
Yeah, I've got that at home. Uh-huh.
So... Basically, for I guess 3 summers, I would read on average a book a day about a native subject.
Oh, I see.
So, mm-hmm. even though I don't have a mind that sort of holds on to detail, I have like this big reservoir of almost intuitive sense of how different native cultures worked.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've done enough reading to mm-hmm. get me 2 or 3 degrees, I mm-hmm.
yeah,
think.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure, it accumulates. That's the nice thing. Yeah. When you said that you would like to eventually sort of become a storyteller and accumulate enough stories, have a repertoire so you could... Would you see yourself then as a storyteller, somebody who travels around and addresses audiences, works with schools or communities, or who would you tell the stories to? Who would you want to tell the stories to?
I guess basically I would like to talk to adult audiences.
Mm-hmm.
I have not been able to quite understand the separation of children from adults in mainstream culture. And as a child, I always resented being treated like a child. And I do my best not to do that to any
mm-hmm.
any young person.
Mm-hmm.
It's really dispiriting.
Yeah.
It's a form of cruelty, I think.
When you write or still tell stories or start bringing something together, do you have specific audiences in mind? And do you write, say, for a native audience or a mixed audience? Or
I don't usually think about an audience
mm-hmm.
to begin with. I usually have a story that excites me or a way of telling a story that excites me. And I believe that if I can write it and instill the piece with my own excitement, that I shouldn't have to worry about a particular audience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once again, I think it's a similar thing to just, you know, seeing children as a separate audience.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe, just from, well, my own experience of, you know, having grown up and seeing a lot of things that are not necessarily meant for children. I can remember when I was in public school in grade 4, finding a copy of Gulliver's Travels, mm-hmm, in the school library, and knowing of it from sort of children's versions of movies,
mm-hmm,
and deciding that I would read this big book,
mm-hmm,
and finding it a real challenge.
It is a challenge.
And I'm sure I didn't understand all of it,
mm-hmm,
but I read it and I got out of it what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've gone back to it since.
It's a wonderful book.
But it's like, basically, I believe that, mm-hmm, to sort of say that this is for children and this is for adults, I mean, that seems to me a form of censorship, a form of mind control.
And what is intriguing, if you think of sort of Western literary tradition, European literary tradition, that so many of the very important books, historically very important books, later on sort of were termed children's literature. If you think of Robinson Crusoe as the expression of modern man, entrepreneur, colonialist, and whatever he is, but he sort of encapsulated some ideals of that time, which I would say now are the wrong ideals. But still, it was a very important book, and it was certainly not written for children. Gulliver's Travels being a satire and with very direct political comments, all of a sudden all the edges taken out and it's turned into children's literature. That's an amazing process. And it also shows that children are not really taken seriously, because a lot of the good stuff is taken out.
Yeah, I believe you can come to a piece of work and you find what you need in that piece of work.
So when people read your poetry, I guess if you read it, you have certain images that you associate with that, and you interpret it your way, the way you wrote it. Now, I usually tell my students, I say, listen, your reading may be totally different from what the author intended. I still think it's an important reading, because it's that text that is a link in a chain of communication. Even though you don't know the author, you bring something to it, you find it, and it's like a mirror, and you have an experience, somebody else has a different one. There's no gospel truth. That's what I feel. I don't know, do you feel like that as an author too?
Yeah.
How do you feel if people read something into a poem and say, that's not in there?
Well, I mean, I have on occasion run across some pretty wild interpretations of things,
uh-huh,
I've written, and I mean, certainly I cannot make those connections, and I don't,
mm-hmm,
understand where what these people are talking about has,
mm-hmm,
come from. But I believe that once I've completed a piece of work and put it out into the public, that it is separate from me,
yeah,
and that what people can give or take from it is part of the process of the way art articulates and embodies the values of our society.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe that I have control over that.
Okay.
I have control over my writing, over that technique.
In the moment that you write it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And when it's finished and out there, it's out there. It's on its own. Yeah, I think so too. But I know that a lot of writers are very uncomfortable with that. And I guess a lot of native writers too, if they put something out and non-natives read it and see something quite different in it, it must be very painful at times, I guess. Do you see yourself at all very prominently as a native writer or just as a contemporary poet? Or is that a racist question?
I guess just for practical concerns. I'd like to call myself a native writer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I use this example all the time, but I heard an interview on national radio with a 19-year-old Cree man who at that point was an ex-alcoholic, drug addict, street prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the interviewer, well, as I was growing up, it was the only choice we had to be on the streets. And I think it's really important for people to know that I'm a native person and that there are other choices in life.
Yeah.
That, you know, writing is not something only mainstream people do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when I go into the center of myself, the labels of native or writer or male, they're not there. But the beginnings of stories are the beginnings of I guess a negotiation with reality. So I was told by parts of my family that even though, as I said, we've been Christianized for a while now, that I'm a member of the Bear Clan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because I don't have the connections to know what that means, I'm making my own connections.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become important to me, and there are, every once in a while, a bear poem pops out of me, and I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I think it's some sort of psychic relic or psychic creation that's just sort of indicative of my own maturing, my own spiritual journey.
Do you think there is something like the collective unconscious that you tap into, that sort of is inherited?
The inheritance idea bugs me. But I really do think that there is something that functions in culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just in language itself.
Yeah.
I mean, if we are not consciously aware of all those under meanings that I was talking about earlier, I think that they function.
Oh yeah. Okay. So it would be like not. In the Jungian sense, something you inherit, but something that is part of the culture and people can tap into. And that is acquired through each person's individual socialization.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it. I'm not very happy about Jung at all. I mean, because of the inheritance thing. He even went as far in one stage, although he was safely in Switzerland, to talk about Semitic and Aryan collective unconscious, you know, and that's exactly where I get worried. I'm very glad to see that.
No, it's.
You see, in Canadian literature, for years and years, there was a lot of myth criticism, and still is, I guess. And some of it, I think, comes from Jung in the long run, although Northrop Frye and other people are important linkages in there, but it's an ideology which for me sort of politically or ideologically partly is suspect because exactly of this inheritance idea.
The
next step is it's in the blood and so on.
I really am troubled by people who use the word race.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, scientifically we are all one race.
Sure.
We have different physical characteristics, and we've gotten into the bad habits of thinking that makes us different. But, I mean, I try always to use the word culture. Because I think that forces people to apprehend that it is the differences in the way we live our lives that is at the real root of our conflict.
Yes. That is, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, most people in Germany wouldn't at this stage, but I certainly do. There are, one of my colleagues is a black German. She's doing my job right now while I'm away. And that's a cultural thing. And that's what she is. That's the language. That's how she lives. It has nothing to do with this or that. Huh? I agree with you absolutely. But unfortunately, a lot of people are still very far away from that or the everyday practices. But that's where it's headed. That was why I was... said is that a racist question or an uncomfortable question? Sort of the categorizations, is this a native author or a non-native author? But the way you explained it from the culture, it makes a lot of sense to me. If you sort of take that concept, the cultural concept, and say, what is it that, do you think there are some common structures that distinguish native writing, native literature from mainstream literature? Where would you see that?
We seem to be developing some sort of dialogues on aesthetic concerns, and they, I mean, this may be simply because these are my own concerns, the oralness or orality, the storytelling, and it may be just because they're my concerns that this is all I'm aware of, but it seems to me that in the other native writers I meet, that those are common concerns as well, aesthetically. But I also think that we have come to the point that we are consciously aware that the traditional values of our societies, of respect for the other person as an individual spirit, that particular value is a much clearer way of positing a route for democracy than the Western democracies have. And that our parallel value of respect for the earth, of the environment as a living entity that's connected to us in the sense of being our mother, that is certainly a more viable way of living our lives on this planet, and making sure that those of us who have children will have a way to live and a place to be. And I mean, we were talking about our names earlier, and I have always resisted becoming the prophet that Moses implies.
I thought when I saw your name, and I when I first heard it, I didn't think about it. Then I looked at it again, Daniel David Moses. I think that's partly because of the cover of the new book. I thought, God, that guy is carrying quite a load. That was my reaction. So,
but it's like I really, in my own thinking and in the thinking of my friends and in the way the world is going, you know, with the collapse of what was happening in the other side of the curtain, and the smugness that is going on here, even though we have problems here that are as great and as threatening to the human spirit as any that were happening there. I mean, they seem to me to be part of one system with just two sides. I feel like I have to explain that this is where the writing is coming from. Mm-hmm. That this concern for larger things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and I think that's what you have in common with a lot of other native
poets. Yeah. My first book of poetry was lyrical, was personal, about my family. And the reception that I did get, although it was limited, was, you know, people liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could very well have easily gone on writing those sorts of poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still write those sorts of poems.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that I had to find other ways of writing, things that would allow me to address larger issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because at root, it's like, for me, writing, as I said, is a spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And spirit, just in the sense of what it all means, you know, what are our values?
Mm-hmm. I've got to look at my little list here, because I want to make sure that I ask those things that I thought about before. One thing I'd like you to maybe talk about is influences. You talked about the oral tradition. Oh no, another one, talking about native literature. You said it has to do with the place, the sort of spiritual place it comes from. And I, this is what I heard from other writers too, and I think it comes through in a lot of native writing. Marie Kemble once said, comes from the mother. The language comes from the mother and the way of seeing things. If you think of native writing, contemporary native writing, no, the whole tradition, would you sort of apply categories like drama and poetry, those genre categories, are they meaningful, or how would you treat the whole body of texts?
I find that I am dissatisfied with those genres, and I'm not sure whether it's simply sort of a natural resistance to codifying something that seems to be in the process of developing.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to give something a wrong name before it's really been born, sort of thing. Or whether it would be just simply a mistake to accept the genre forms when perhaps something, I think I'm repeating myself here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have an opportunity here with the influence of an oral aesthetic,
yes,
to develop things that go beyond those genres, which are things that are very much a result of a book culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I look at native writing in Canada, or the, what I know about it, and then read a lot of native writing coming from the U.S., there are quite a few differences. I was always wondering why is it that there's so much more drama in Canada as compared to the U.S. Now I use those categories,
yeah.
And I think I thought, okay, partly it's the government policy. There are subsidized theater companies and so on, which don't exist in the U.S. But that couldn't be all. And then I think the answer for me, the most meaningful answer I got in that was, and I hadn't thought about it in those terms, was Thompson Highway saying, well, it's the form that is closest to the oral tradition. And if you look at most of native writing in Canada, what distinguishes it very much, I think, from a lot of very good, very famous writing out of the U.S. is that it's much closer in general to the oral tradition and to the traditions, whereas the creme of writing in the U.S. are people who are English professors.
Yeah.
And come from that tradition and blend it with native culture, of course. But would you say that this is, does that make sense to you?
That seems true to me. I actually haven't read all that much of the American writers,
mm-hmm.
but the ones I've come across, most of them seem to be like
especially in fiction,
beautiful writing,
mm-hmm.
but it's also because it's writing that for me is often too beautiful. It has lost its impulse. Whatever is impelling the story,
okay,
it's there. There's a certain point where I guess it becomes art for art's sake, rather than for the story's sake or for communication's sake. And, I mean, I distrust some of my own work that has become that beautiful. I think it's somehow smug and self-satisfied, and I try not to
when
do that, even
that,
though.
Which text do you think of?
Well, there are a few poems in the new book that, that are. I can think my editor saying, "God, I wish I'd written that," and I was thinking, "Well, I'm not as satisfied with having done it." Let's see, which one did she say? Passing above the Black River, for instance. I mean, it's a sequence of lovely images, and I think it gets the experience across. But somehow, for me, I think it's too pretty, and that the actual, I guess, darkness. The there is a journey to in there. It ends up being perhaps over refined.
That turns it also into an academic literary tradition almost.
To
say it's too refined, maybe in those categories, or am I off the track?
That's a good description of.
But somebody saying, who knows a lot about writing, would say, it's beautiful writing.
I think it has to do with my moving into the ideas of writing as performance, where you come to realize that every performance is unique and has its own beauties. And that the obsessiveness that one gets when one's writing poetry, wanting to get everything right, at a certain point is just wasting one's time. I mean, certainly I've learned in writing plays that you can get your message across without having everything the way you want them. I mean, there are times when your actors can just not handle some of the things you're doing.
And do you work with actors when Coyote City has been produced, right?
Right.
Did you work with the cast?
Yes. And it's very important in the process just to make sure it's all working.
Do you find that when you're working with actors who are putting it on stage, do you revise the play?
I did, certainly. I removed one long sequence from the play.
What made you do that? Did you realize it didn't work on the stage, or it was redundant, or the actor couldn't do it?
It wasn't working on the stage, and the necessary information I was able to integrate into other scenes.
I see.
But it was slowing down the play. It wasn't as alive as the rest of the piece.
I asked you this earlier when we were eating lunch or so. I realized in reading Coyote City, there is the Orpheus and Yuri Taichi. myth in there, or at least that's what I recognized in it, and also it is a story or a play that happens while the story, the native story that it's based on, is being told. I saw it as a play also about a story, or telling a story, a story fulfilling itself, or whatever you call it. What intrigued me was did you sort of consciously blend the Greek tradition and the native tradition, or
Well, actually, it was the native traditional story that got me going. I mean, I sort of vaguely remembered that there was a Greek one, but...
Oh, yeah, I see. So that didn't influence you at all, then?
Well, very peripherally, but it really was a matter of... It was Coyote and the Shadow People.
Mm-hmm.
Lunar showed me that story one day, and I just... It really went to my heart, and I knew that something would grow from it. And you know, the actual sort of attempting to tell the story while the play was happening, it was sort of my first experiment of trying to deal with the different ways of presenting. Actually, I think we've come to term that sort of element in a play as presentational, as opposed to I don't know, lyrical elements or poetic elements. Or.
Is it also a play about a story, or that while you tell a story, what you tell in the story, things happen? The reason I'm saying this is, I don't know, maybe. No, Leslie Silko's story, Storyteller?
Yeah.
Or Ceremony?
I know, Ceremony.
That also, in a way, is about words having effects beyond words, or a story being told or not told and having to be told so it can fulfill itself. And I thought I saw a parallel in Coyote City, but maybe I'm not
the
truthful. Or did you let the story tell as sort of background information, say this is what it's based on?
I mean, certainly that I think is the way it functions when you watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was making it, I was really dealing with the individual character's psychology.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
So it was the character of Boo.
Mm-hmm.
This is what she has to hold on to through the play.
Yeah.
And equally for Johnny, like this is part of Johnny's problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that it worked out that I managed to tell most of that story in the play through those characters' dilemmas is both luck and art.
Yeah.
And that in the final analysis it plays for the audience as I suppose something ceremonial, something that has to do with story as
the power of
guide
stories.
Or representation of life.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the broader thing that one hopes will happen.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think that is at the root of a lot of belief in stories or myth or whatever. Even if you think in Christian terms, in the beginning there was the word. Is it am Anfang war das Wort? Isn't it? I think that's the translation. Even there is a conviction that words have a power beyond what I see on the written page.
Yeah.
And I thought one could see that play also as a documentation of that. That there are some stories who fulfill themselves. If you then take a European audience, seeing that and not aware, only learning about that Coyote story through the play, but recognizing some of the stuff that is going on in the play, recognizing in inverted commas, because they know the Greek myth, I think that would maybe even document that there are certain stories that people are familiar with or relate to from various cultures. And I found that very intriguing. Maybe because I'm a non-native person. You know, and say, hey, I don't know. And you don't feel left out.
Well, it is one of those great human dilemmas, love and death come together like that. And I mean, those simple human situations, are common to all cultures. And I think there are arguments that those, there are certain stories that you will find again and again.
Yeah.
But I have to caution people, like, there are only a certain number of those stories, and not all stories are the same.
No.
I can remember hearing one of our more popular children's entertainers and storytellers in the city of Toronto talking about how he really believed that stories were for everybody, and everybody could share stories, and which is a very nice liberal thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to talk about how he'd gone up into an Inuit community and how they told stories back and forth. And just sort of, by the way, he mentioned the fact that, like, 75% of the stories, he didn't understand what they were talking about. He didn't get it, and they didn't get what he was talking about. I mean, most of our stories are very based in our separate cultures.
Yeah.
And like, this goes into the appropriation thing.
Exactly.
It's like, if people from the opposite culture try and tell those stories, they don't know what's going on. They're just going to screw them up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what's getting us upset. You say you want the freedom to tell our stories, and then you just screw it up.
Yeah.
You know, freedom of the imagination shouldn't be the freedom to destroy.
I think it's also the clash between an oral way of transmitting stories.